It's the morning show. I'm Shereen Seward in for Kate Archer-Kent. Scientists say climate change is already having dire consequences, both in the U.S. and around the world. Rising temperatures that have worsened extreme weather events led to longer wildfire seasons and increased drought. According to the U.N. Food and Agriculture Organization, those impacts cause ripple effects as crop yields are compromised, resulting in rising food prices and disruptions to supply chains. President Joe Biden pledged to return the U.S. to the international stage on climate action, and now the country is poised to see a landmark bill that addresses emissions and energy, representing the country's biggest climate investment in history. Join in this conversation at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Michael Mann is a professor in the Department of Earth and Environmental Science at the University of Pennsylvania. Michael, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. It's great to be with you.
Well, Congress failed to act on climate change for decades. Are you surprised by this bill? Are you surprised that there is action being taken?
Yeah, a little, just because it looked like these efforts were basically dead just a month ago after Joe Manchin had indicated that he would not vote for anything that resembled the so-called Build Back Better plan, the original legislation that had many of these climate provisions. And so it sort of came out of the blue that all of a sudden Manchin had indeed been keeping, you know, ongoing conversations going with his colleagues, with his fellow Democrats, and that they had, in fact, come to a, you know, resolution. They had come to, you know, a compromise in the form of this legislation that was something that Joe Manchin could get behind that has real provisions. There's real climate action in this legislation. It might not be everything that climate advocates would have liked to see. And there are a few things in this bill that, you know, many of us wish wasn't there. For example, the support for additional drilling leases and other fossil fuel infrastructure like pipelines. There are some things in there that aren't great, but this was probably the best legislation that could come out of this closely divided 50-50 Senate, where, you know, the critical vote is by a coal state senator in Joe Manchin. And my view is, you know, you take the win. This is, you know, this bill has provisions that really will make a difference. You take this win now and you work towards something even better. And as we look towards these midterm elections, there's the possibility of a larger majority in the Senate that would support more aggressive climate legislation. But for the time being, this gives us this, you know, it gives us a start down this path, and it keeps alive the hope of averting catastrophic planetary warming.
Well, the bill seeks to address climate change in multiple ways. One proposal would be to provide $260 billion in clean energy tax credits. So essentially, instead of punishing dirty energy, incentivizing clean energy. So can you explain what those credits do?
Sure. And so that's sort of the carrot. And I would argue, and many climate advocates would argue, you probably need both the carrot and the stick. You want to incentivize clean energy, but you need to disincentivize fossil fuel energy at the same time if you're going to sort of get those priorities right, if you're going to level the playing field so that clean energy can compete fairly against fossil fuel energy. But as you allude to, there is quite a bit of carrot here. There are loans and grants and tax credits for business and for consumers to help further, you know, the continued manufacturing and use of renewable energy, of wind turbines and solar panels and electric vehicles. So there's this, you know, effectively this stimulus that will help accelerate this transition that's already underway from fossil fuels towards renewable energy. And when you total up all of those provisions, the effect of those provisions, and there's some provisions regarding methane, which is also a potent greenhouse gas, agricultural carbon emissions, there are a number of provisions in the bill that will help us decarbonize collectively our economy, enough so that according to estimates by a number of independent groups, including the Rhodium Group, a group of policy experts that does sort of rigorous analyses of these sorts of plans, they've estimated that this will yield up to maybe 40% reductions in carbon emissions in the United States by 2030, by the end of this decade. Now, that's not quite enough. Our commitment to the world, and we have to keep that commitment, is to lower our carbon emissions 50% by 2030. But this gets us quite a bit down that path. And there is, of course, the hope that in the next Congress, there might be, you know, a majority of senators in support of even more aggressive legislation that can get us that 50% reductions that we really need.
We're talking about the climate change provisions in the Inflation Reduction Act. It's the bill approved by the Senate and is expected to be voted on today by the House. With us is Michael Mann from the University of Pennsylvania. The legislation would provide $80 billion in rebates for consumers to buy electric vehicles, home heat pumps, and other products. What's the strategy here?
Yeah, I mean, the strategy is, you know, again, you know, a carrot. Get accelerate this transition that's already happening. You know, there's a saying that the Stone Age didn't end for want of stones. Stone Age didn't end because we ran out of stones. It ended because we found a better way of living. The same is true of fossil fuels. The fossil fuel age won't end for want of fossil fuels. It won't end because we've run out of fossil fuels. We have five times as much fossil fuels that are in proven reserves, five times as much as is necessary to warm the planet beyond a disastrous 2 degrees Celsius, you know, nearly 4 degrees Fahrenheit. So we can't afford to burn all the fossil fuels that are even in the proven reserves of the fossil fuel industry today. We need to stop burning fossil fuels, and we need to replace that energy with clean renewable sources. The solution to the problem exists. There are some who insist that we need magic new technology to solve the problem. Bill Gates is actually one of those individuals. He's said we need a miracle. We don't. The miracle is there. It's the wind. It's the sun. It's geothermal energy. It's energy conservation. It's all of these things that we can implement. We have the technology now. We just need the political will to do it. We just need the market signals that move us in that direction. And that's what this bill really does. It allows us to greatly expand the reach of renewable energy technology while instituting energy conservation measures. And again, getting us down that path that we need to go down. Now, there are some provisions in the bill, for example, as we alluded to earlier, the expansion of pipelines and oil drilling leases, that are sort of a step back. And so this bill, in a sense, is several steps forward, but, you know, a step or two back as well when it comes to the support for fossil fuel infrastructure that's in there in part to, you know, so that the bill could garner the support of Joe Manchin. It would be nice to get rid of those provisions subsequently and to institute something like carbon pricing or a renewable energy standard, portfolio standard, which requires utilities to provide an increasing share of electricity from renewable sources. It would be nice to have a little more of the stick that you know that disincentivizes fossil fuel energy. And
so
there
less carrot here. Less carrot, yeah. more stick is what you're saying.
Keep the carrot, even more carrot, but some stick to go with it. And I think we might get something that resembles that. Again, if voters turn out in droves in these midterm elections, and we, you know, we have a larger majority in support of climate action, we can get some of these more aggressive provisions, because let's you know, make it clear, this doesn't get us all the way. This gets us 40% reductions by 2030, which is a great start. We need 50% reductions if we are to help stay on this path that averts catastrophic warming, that keeps the warming of the planet below a very dangerous 3 degrees Fahrenheit.
We'll talk more about the U.S. Senate's climate change legislation with climate scientist Michael Mann after this break. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Shereen Seward. Michael Mann is the author of The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. He's here to make sense of sweeping legislation approved by the U.S. Senate recently to fight climate change and answer your questions, too. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. John from Rice Lake is with us. John, hi.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What would you like to know?
Well, there's several points I'd like to make. I travel with RV from Washington through Nevada, Arizona in the past couple of years. And listening to NPR in Nevada, which is one of the better states for collecting solar, with solar panels, the state's energy commissioner was on, and basically what they were saying is that they don't want, it's actually against law for any resident to install more than 1,000 watts of solar panels. Now, commercially, they can install as much as they want. So it kind of doesn't make any sense. In Wisconsin, I heard a couple weeks ago on NPR the same thing from the energy commissioner, that they don't want residents having solar panels because it increases the cost for people that don't per kilowatt hour. For people that don't have solar. And the other thing I'd like to say is that in the RV industry, everybody is going solar. RVs are, almost everyone that you see out in the Midwest is solar, and it's a big growing industry, so that you don't have to run your generator or anything. You can run just about everything except AC and microwave, but most people with big money are able to install enough panels on the roof to even run those. So those are my points. But, it just doesn't make sense for the federal government to enact incentives, and then on the other end, statewide to cap it.
Okay, thanks, John. Michael, what do you say to that? What about that resistance?
Yeah, thanks, John, for, that's it's a really important point. You do, at the state level, you actually sometimes encounter disincentives. Infamously, North Carolina tried to outlaw the sale of Teslas at one point. It was their conservative supermajority that was basically doing the bidding of the fossil fuel industry and doing everything they could to dampen in their state, in the state of North Carolina, the growth of renewable energy, in this case, in the form of electric vehicles. So you do encounter this. There are conservative state legislatures that have passed policies like this that make no sense whatsoever. At least now we've got these incentives at the national level, and that's going to make a real difference. But you're right, we have to recognize the importance of our votes at every level. If we have, a president in a Congress that's willing to do something about climate, but at the state level, we continue to elect politicians. And frankly, to be honest, there's one party right now that is behind climate action, the Democratic Party, and there's one party that has opposed it at every turn, the Republican Party. We have to think about that when we vote, that every vote matters. It matters at the national level. It matters at the local and state level. We get the politicians we vote for. And if we want policies that will reflect our values, the desire for clean energy at the state level, we've got to elect state politicians who will support that rather than politicians who will simply do the bidding for the fossil fuel industry.
There's also some pushback from the auto industry because of the provisions that go along with the tax, yeah. the credits for electric vehicles, $7,500 for a new one, up to $4,000 for a used vehicle. But there's some rules there that say that those vehicles have to be assembled in the U.S. So what yeah. do you say to that?
Yeah, so that's sort of tricky, and it's made some of these estimates of you know, the net effect of this legislation a bit tricky because you have to take into account the intricacies of the these credits. And there is, you know, this provision that says that, you know, that a lot of the technology has to be manufactured in the United States using, American, resources. That is going to somewhat limit the impact that this would otherwise have, but policy experts think that can essentially be accomplished. It's going to take a lot of work to do that, but that we do have the manufacturing capacity here in the United States, and understandably, there were a number of politicians who voted for this legislation that wanted something that directly sort of supports workers and the American economy. And so this was sort of one of those provisions to try to make sure that the funding provided by the bill really does stimulate economic growth in the United States. I can see where they were coming from on that. I can understand why those provisions are there, but the caller is absolutely right. It will make it a little bit trickier to basically, mm-hmm. Achieve the sort of transition to electric vehicles that we would like to see. It's going to slow that a bit.
We're talking with Michael Mann, a climate scientist, about legislation approved by the U.S. Senate to fight climate change. The big question is this enough? The legislation is a big step in fighting climate change, but some people say it's not going to solve the problem. Is it enough? And if not, what do we need to do?
Yeah, it's enough to reestablish American leadership. And that's really important right now because if the United States isn't on the table, doing everything that it can to meet its obligations to the rest of the world, then it gets difficult to convince the Chinas and the Indias and developing countries to do their part. So it was really important. And we have that both in Biden's commitment at the Glasgow Climate Conference last year, and now codified in this legislation that the United States is working hard to meeting its obligation. Its promise to the rest of the world is to lower carbon emissions here in the United States by 50% by 2030. And that's what we need to do globally if we're going to avert a catastrophic 3-degree Fahrenheit warming of the planet. So this doesn't get us all the way there. We need a 50% reduction. The analysts, and there's some uncertainty here, but the analysts say basically this gets us somewhere between sort of the high 30s and the low 40s, probably around 40% reductions. So it doesn't get us everything we need. It isn't the solution to the problem, but it gets us on the right path and it sends a signal to the rest of the world, which is so critical right now.
We have about a minute left together, and I guess you bring up a good point here when you talk about other countries. I'm curious how you see this legislation really affecting efforts by other countries to also join in the fight against climate change.
Yeah, well, Australia just elected a new government, a Labour independent coalition that has supported a similar reduction in carbon emissions. So suddenly Australia's back at the table. They were at the back of the line. Now they're at the front of the line. The United States is near the front, too. And so I feel pretty good about where we're headed. But we do have to meet our obligations. And 40% isn't enough. We need to hit that 50% mark reductions by 2030. That means folks have to turn out in this election. These midterm elections are an opportunity for us to elect climate champions who will fight for even more aggressive legislation that'll get us all the way to where we need to be.
Last 30 seconds here. Some environmentalists are claiming that this legislation will make the U.S. a world leader in battling climate change. Is that the case?
It gets us down that path. I don't think we can declare victory yet. But this is the monumental. It's the most aggressive climate legislation we've ever passed. It comes at a critical moment where we need that leadership to basically incentivize all the countries of the world to come together. The U.S. is the world's largest cumulative carbon emitter on the planet. And if we're not leading on this issue, we can't expect others to come along. Now we have that leadership, but we have to, you know, continue sure. to strengthen this legislation. We need to pass provisions.
Michael, that is so interesting. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate having you here.
Thank you very much.
Michael Mann, a professor in the Department of Earth and Environmental Science at the University of Pennsylvania. He's the author of 5 books, including The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. Ahead this hour, we'll take a tour of the port of Green Bay, which is seeing an uptick in ship traffic. Join in 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. News update and a story from Wisconsin Life are next on the Ideas Network. The morning show. I'm Shereen Seward in for Kate Archer Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with an answer to a question about language.
Wisconsin recently received a listener question from Catherine Bolt. She wonders, what is the third most commonly spoken language in Wisconsin after English and Spanish? The answer? Hmong. WPR's Mary Kate McCoy looks into why.
That was Macy Herr, the executive director of Hmong Wisconsin Chamber of Commerce, introducing herself in Hmong.
So I'm Hmong American. I grew up, for the most part, in the Wausau area, attended high school there.
Herr calls herself a 1.5 generation Hmong American, meaning she moved to the United States with her parents when she was young. Many Hmong Americans who came to the United States from Southeast Asia were from isolated mountain villages in Laos, Vietnam, and Thailand. During the Vietnam War, the U.S. recruited many Hmong people to help fight the North Vietnamese. When the U.S. withdrew from Vietnam in 1975, thousands of Hmong fled to refugee camps in Thailand and later resettled in the U.S.
There are many families that were sponsored by groups and organizations, many of them faith-based or churches specifically in the Wisconsin area. We ended up moving to Wisconsin to be with the rest of our, or should I say, a good portion of our family in Wisconsin.
Today, about 50,000 Hmong people call Wisconsin home, making it the third largest state population in the country behind California and Minnesota. While Hmong is the third most commonly spoken language in Wisconsin behind English and Spanish, less than 1% of the population speaks it. UNESCO predicts the Hmong language will likely die out by the end of this century. Song Shong, executive director of Gia Shia in La Crosse, said there are several reasons for that. She spoke with me about it from home as her child played in another room.
Hmong is one of the hardest languages to learn because it's a tonal language. You know, a lot of Westerners have a hard time speaking Mandarin because it's 4 tones. And with Hmong, you double those, so it's 8 tones.
The meaning of a word changes based on the tone used.
So, for example, if I was to say the word red in Hmong is lia. So if I say the word in different tones, it will go something like lia, 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 lia.
The different tones change the word from red to rice paddy, disgusting, and rice harvesting tool. The other 4 tones don't have meaning. And then Sean points to the difference between generations.
It's also a dying language because it's not being passed down at all. It's not being used. The folks that use it are our elders who don't speak any other language other than Hmong.
English is everywhere, Herr says. While she can speak Hmong conversationally, teaching it to her 6-year-old son is a challenge when he's surrounded by English in school, with his friends, and on television.
I fear for myself my own son, you know, for as someone who values the language and the culture, it's hard to pass those things down to your child in a society where you still want them to thrive and understand the culture in which they live in.
But those hurdles don't keep her and Shang from being optimistic. They both organize annual Hmong language and culture camps for kids. And her says she sees signs of younger Hmong people looking to reclaim their heritage.
The Hmong are an indigenous group of people. You know, we don't have a home country to go back to. Whatever we can keep alive, the people, the language is so, so important.
Shang says to really keep the language alive, it will take those in the Hmong community coming together and advocating for the language to be implemented in grade schools and universities.
But most importantly, I think it takes non-Hmong folks to also support those causes. It comes from the Hmong community wanting it, and then the dominant culture, non-Hmong folks also advocating for those things as well.
WPR digital producer Mary Kate McCoy brought us that story on the Hmong language, the third most commonly spoken language in Wisconsin. She answered an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It's the morning show. I'm Shereen Seward in for Kate Archer-Kent. Green Bay's port is a bulk commodities port. That means they receive products like limestone and salt, petroleum products, liquid asphalt, and forest products, in addition to oversized cargo like machinery and wind components. In Green Bay, cargo shipments nearly doubled from May to June. But what does that say about the economy? Join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dean Hain is the Port of Green Bay Director. Dean, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
Well, the Port of Green Bay typically receives shipments for agriculture, manufacturing, construction. How many shipments is the port seeing compared to previous months?
Well, over the course of a typical year, we'll see about 175 to 200 ships transit in and out of the port. And on a monthly basis, that we're open about 9 months a year, so let's just divide it out. We'll see 25 to 30 ships per month.
Supply chain disruptions are affecting so many industries. We're hearing about it all the time. But what is the Port of Green Bay experiencing?
Well, those supply chains are real. And it's an experience here in the Port of Green Bay as well. Fortunately, it's maybe not as severe. So as a port that is bringing in raw materials for construction, manufacturing, agricultural industries, those are more readily available. It's the finished goods that seem to have more of the supply chain crises that are happening and shortages. So we're somewhat sheltered from that, but it is still impactful.
The Duluth Superior Port recently expanded its export service to ship waterborne cargo containers. In June, the morning show spoke with the executive director, Deb DeLuca, about the new service.
Well, ultimately, it means more flexibility, more options for supply chain solutions through our multimodal logistics hub here at the Duluth Seaway Port Authority. And that multimodal logistics hub is also known as the Clure Public Marine Terminal.
Dean, how does the Port of Green Bay plan to use this service?
As well as in Duluth, in Green Bay, and throughout the Great Lakes, we're all looking at the future, and we believe the future is going to involve moving containers. As fuel prices rise and road congestion increases, I think we're going to see a movement going back to the water and moving things around the Great Lakes in containerized traffic.
I understand the Port of Green Bay is seeing more limestone imports this year compared to last year. What do you think is causing that?
Well, limestone is a very broadly used product. So it's soft stone. It's in your toothpaste. It's put in the smokestack scrubbers so that pollution is captured before it's emitted into the atmosphere. It's in agricultural applications. It's in animal feed. It's really a unique product, and that just really grows, and we have really strong companies here in Green Bay that are using those in a variety of applications.
Now I can't stop thinking about limestone in my toothpaste. Thanks for that. I've never heard that before. I learned something new today. So what does having a high number of cargo shipments in June really say about the local economy? Does it spark any kind of indicator for you?
It does. I usually like to think of the Port of Green Bay as about a six-month leading indicator for our regional economy. So when we are moving large amounts of raw materials, that means companies are bringing in those raw materials because they're planning on producing, whether it's in construction, agriculture, manufacturing. So we're looking good, and it's like about a six-month window. Anything beyond that, and it kind of can change. We've had seasons where we start off super strong, looks like it's going to be a great season, and then the second half of the year just wanes. So the fact that we are doing as well or better than we were last year at this time is a reflection of the economy of northeastern Wisconsin.
Trade groups and others aren't quite as optimistic as you are. So what do you say to that?
I've been doing this for 20 years, and this is what I see on a very micro level, right? I'm looking at northeastern Wisconsin.
Well, last month, the Federal Reserve raised interest rates to 2.5%. How is that affecting shipping? What impact does that have?
Well, I think that is more down the road in that these manufacturers and construction companies, they're probably not investing as much into their company, buying new equipment, machinery, building facilities. But with what the port is doing, we're supplying what they have today. So I think those interest rates are more going to be more felt going forward in terms of reinvestment.
Dean Hain is the Port of Green Bay director here to discuss the relationship between shipping and the local and national economic outlook. You can join in the discussion, too. 800-642-1234. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Shereen Seward. We return to our conversation with Dean Hain, director at the Port of Green Bay, which saw a significant rise in shipments from May to June. Join us at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Earlier this year, Governor Tony Evers announced a $15 million state grant that would move coal piles away from downtown Green Bay. How do you envision that project impacting the port's operations?
It'll impact it in multi roles here. So we have a decommissioned power plant at the mouth of the river that has been taken down. We've purchased it, and we're planning on reinventing that into a state-of-the-art port facility in which the Sea Rice Coal Company can be relocated out there. So it's got deeper water, better interstate connection, and has rail access. And then what would happen with their existing property is that would be repurposed into fit in more into the downtown neighborhood, where it will transition from softer uses to light industrial to then have a port use on the southern part of that property. And that would generate port growth, which will create jobs and be a betterment for northeastern Wisconsin.
Is the $15 million enough to cover all the costs related to removing those coal piles off of the riverfront property?
Well, first I'd like to clarify, we're not going to move coal piles. We're going to relocate a company, so we'll consume the coal and then reestablish a pile somewhere else. And the $15 million is only part of the equation. We estimate that this project at the Polium plant property, this power plant that I speak of, is about $30 million. So in addition to that, 15, we have other grant applications in to the federal government, as well as to the Wisconsin Department of Transportation.
Thanks for clarifying that. How long will this process take?
If we had the full resources needed to redevelop that site today, we would have 1 year of engineering and permitting and design, and then probably a year and a half of construction. So we're probably 2.5 to 3 years away from being able to reuse this property as a port facility, but that's also dependent upon having the full amount of resources.
So a long process. Well, labor shortages, of course, happening all throughout Wisconsin. We've been hearing that from so many people. There are needs for nurses, teachers, manufacturers, other professionals. What about the port? Are you impacted by this workforce shortage as well?
Oh, certainly. I mean, it is affecting, as you just mentioned, everywhere. There's just there's a lot of people have retired, and there's others that are just have left the labor market. So we are challenged to have truck drivers. We're challenged to have dock operators, clerical staff. It's across the board. There is a huge labor shortage that everyone's trying to deal with.
How are you working to find more workers while retaining the people you want to keep? It's got to be such a challenge.
It certainly is. So, you know, you have to have competitive wages, and you have to be flexible and meet the needs of today's workers. And you also got to look at how you can change services. If you can reduce services or change services to try to better use your labor resources, that's another aspect to meeting the challenges of a reduced labor market.
Well, you're certainly not alone in that challenge. We're talking about the Port of Green Bay with its top administrator, Dean Hain. This summer, the business lobbying group Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce released a new survey about the state's economy. And what that said, about 70% of members said they expect a recession in the next 12 months. Not everybody agrees with this, but what's your view?
Well, as I mentioned in the earlier segment, I really only can look out 6 months. That's what the port seems to kind of give us a clue on. And, you know, things are strong right now, and that would put us into the winter months. Going forward, we have to have some type of correction with this inflation. You know, if inflationary costs stay this high, there's going to be less consumption. If there's less consumption, the port is bringing in less raw materials for manufacturing, for agriculture and construction.
But so far, you see some room for optimism here.
I'm trying to be optimistic and hope that
we all are. I want to talk to you about the cruise ships. This was such a cool story. In June, the Port of Green Bay saw its first cruise ship. I never thought I would see a cruise ship in the Port of Green Bay. Do you expect more of the ships to move through the port? And what was that like?
Yeah, so this is something we've been trying to do, and the Great Lakes has been trying to do for a number of years, and we were happy to welcome two cruise ships this past summer, just in June and July that just happened. And for next year, we're looking at having about 8 come in, and we're hoping that this is a trend that's going to continue. The people that are on board really seem to enjoy northeastern Wisconsin culture and other factors of the area that are of interest to them. So we're hoping that this continues, and it's really exciting for these visitors. And I think it's more of a prestigious thing for the community, right? People are looking at it and saying, wow, people are actually taking vacation and traveling to Green Bay other
right.
than a Packer game.
Yeah, you know. Exactly. I mean, so when the cruise ships come, then do the passengers get off and spend some time in Green Bay? Is that how it works?
Yes. So there can be a variety of ways they visit. They can spend the night. But for the most part, just like the Caribbean, the intention of these cruise ships are to travel by night, get to a new port of call, get everybody up, get them off the vessel, let them explore the community, and then reboard and depart.
So how does that impact the community, like from an economic standpoint and, I mean, just from an excitement point of view?
Yeah, so these cruise ships don't have a huge amount of passengers. I mean, when you think about the Packers and their and the amount of travelers that come into Green Bay and what they're spending, that's huge. You know, these are small cruise ships with only 400 passengers. But they are spending their dollars in the community. What it also drives is others wanting to come into the community to see this cruise ship and to see these passengers, whether they're European or they're American passengers. There's interest, and people will come in to see that vessel and to greet the passengers. And then I also think it is like, wow, people are coming to Green Bay. I live somewhere else in Wisconsin. I've got to go check out that community. And so we mm-hmm. get additional visitors that want to come into the community to explore it.
Really curious about your job. I mean, you're administrator at Port of Green Bay. What's a day in the life like for you?
Well, you know, it changes throughout the year, right? So in the winter months, you think, oh, well, the port's closed for, you know, 2 months. There must be nothing to do. Mm-hmm. Well, that is probably the busiest time because that's when every federal and state agency wants reports, whether it's the Coast Guard, Corps of Engineers, DNR, EPA, and so on. Everyone wants a report. So there's a lot of paperwork in the winter. And then as the shipping season's building, we're advocating for, you know, dredging and navigational aids being put in. And then throughout the year, we're working on economic development, trying to get new businesses that want to use the port. And then also we're working on legislative and regulatory issues that positively or negatively affect the port operators.
Looking to the future, what products does the port hope to ship more of in the future, see more of?
Yeah, Shereen, you mentioned it earlier about containers. Mm-hmm. We think that is a huge growth area where we need to move towards. And then it's really about looking at the region and saying, okay, what's happening that products are getting into the area by another means. And when you look at Northeast Wisconsin, it's a large amount of manufacturing. Matter of fact, you can look at I-43 on a daily basis and see barred coiled steel coming up on flatbed trucks. So that's an opportunity. Why aren't we bringing in barred and coiled steel right to Green Bay by water? So that's an opportunity. You know, we're doing a lot of manufacturing. They're making paper machines in the region. And so that's an opportunity. And then you look at what we're good at in the area, right? Agriculture. Well, fertilizer. What about liquid or dry fertilizer? So we're always looking at these different markets and trying to find a way to enter that market and have the port serve that industry in a better way. And it's ports are and ships are generally very cost effective. You can move a large amount of goods very low cost, but it's also slower. So that's a trade-off. You know, sure. Ships aren't as fast as other means.
There are multiple ports, of course, throughout Wisconsin. How is the Green Bay port different from others in the state? I'm curious about that.
Yeah, one thing about ports is if you see one port, you've seen one port. They're really all different. Some ports are more into real estate, and other ports are more into actually doing the operations. And so when you look at the Port of Green Bay, the port itself owns limited land and resources that we lease. So we do some leasing, but we don't do any operations. So we're here. We have 14 businesses that are using the port today, moving ships in and out, and we're like their legislative regulatory aid, right? We're here to help them make sure that they can do their business. So we'll take care of making sure that the channel's dredged and that dredge material has a place to go and that there's whatever issues at hand that we're working on their behalf so they're not hindered in what they're doing.
Thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate having you here today.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Dean Hain is the Port of Green Bay director. Just ahead, the Wisconsin primary election is in the books and a record-breaking number of women campaigning for governor. We discuss the uptick with a scholar studying women in politics. I'm Shereen Seward. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.